ज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्याभिनन्दनशलाकया चाक्षुर्मिलितां येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नाम शिष्टं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रं अत्र स्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरोपरि मथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरं महो राधिकमधावशम् प्राप्तो यस्य प्रतीत्तकृपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मह्यं ददाति स्वापदंकितम् हे कृष्ण करुणा सिन्धु दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपिका कान्तराधकान्त नमस्तुते तप्त कंचन गौरंगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुतदेवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसदि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे श्री सच्चिदानंद गौर हरि की जय श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय गौर भक्त वृंद की जय गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हो So, welcome to all of you. Dhanyabad, thank you so much for coming today to this beautiful, intimate gathering. Thank you so much for the invitation, Marvi and the family, to host us here. So, today we are continuing with the series of topics we shared the last week. Basically, and the main topic is rediscovering our relationship with Krishna. So just the title in itself, at least for me, it's a good reminder that there is a place to rediscover our relationship with Krishna. There is a place for rediscovery in relationships, and not only there is a place, but without rediscovering there is no relationship. Basically, we know you can apply to any relationship you have. If the relationship is not in a constant process of rediscovery, how much of the relationship remains there? So the very nature of relationships is one of rediscovery. That's how reality operates. And everything is related to everything else. So when I talk about relationship, it's not just about me and Krishna, you and me, but everything with everything, because everything exists in relationship. Reality is relational. Reality is in relationship with everything else. That's the very meaning of the term sambandha. Sambandha, everything sambandha, tied together, connected with the common center, the divine. One name for Krishna is Mukhya Sambandha. He, in relationship to whom, everyone has its primary relationship. So everything has its primary connection with God in the center, but we are interrelated as well for sharing a common center. So in order to keep the pace of this relational nature of reality, we have to engage in rediscovery. We have to remain open to know the person we are relating to again, to rediscover the person, not to take for granted the other person, and also to allow ourselves to be rediscovered by the persons who are relating to us. Because if we remain in a defensive mechanism, in hiding mode, we do not allow ourselves to be discovered for who we are, how much there is a relationship. If I'm trying to relate to you, but I keep hiding, I keep putting on masks, I keep performing and showing myself of who I am not, how much of a relationship I'm having. I'm not showing up, I'm not allowing myself to be discovered. What to speak if we want a relationship with Krishna? I mean, he's so transparent, he's so open to be rediscovered over and over again. He's perpetually engaged in this project of rediscovery. As we were saying the other day, one of the many names of Krishna is Urukrama. So Urukrama means he who take very bold steps, Urukrama. But sometimes it's translated as the great adventurer. No. So he is, who is willing to for adventure, he who is ready for adventure at any moment. And any relationship is an adventure, basically. I mean, relating to anyone is an adventure. To discover the other person, to be discovered by the other person, for you to rediscover yourself when you are being discovered by the other person. It's very interesting dynamics. So, of course, we want to develop a relationship with Krishna. That's Krishna consciousness, to keep in relationship, to keep developing our relationship. Krishna consciousness is not a set of, how to say, definitive dogmas that once you learn the correct beliefs, you are saved and you don't need to do anything else. But Krishna consciousness is a quantum leap into the adventure of relating with God, who, as we talk these days, can be described as an ever-evolving mystery. Krishna is always becoming more of himself. Krishna is always upgrading his own self. So imagine how exciting is a relationship with a person like that. It can be a little unsettling if we are too attached to certainty and to things being the same, as we talked last week. Now, if we are addicted to certainty, good luck with Krishna, right? If I'm a certainty junkie, so to say, good luck with Krishna, because he's very dynamic. He's never the same person after the next second. He's always ready for adventure. He's always willing to rediscover himself, each other, wonder. So that's love. Love is a very adventurous project. So in our last meeting, we were talking a few things about that, how Krishna, in one sense, we can know so much about Krishna, but the fact that we know so much about Krishna doesn't mean that we have figured him out completely and we have him in our grasp, right? That was, as we mentioned, what Brahma thought in the Brahma Vimohan Lila. He thought, I know who Krishna is. And then when he met him again in Vrindavan, Krishna was like, don't be so sure that you know who I am. No? And Brahma became bewildered, because of being too certain about who Krishna was, and Krishna disrupted that template. No? He's the supreme disruptor, in a good sense of the term. No? He disrupts what needs to be disrupted. But we have to be willing to be disrupted also by his grace. So today we have another meeting, a third meeting in this series of rediscovering our relationship with Krishna. And there are different ways, in my opinion, in which we can rediscover our relationship with Krishna, in which we can recalibrate our usual ways of thinking about God. Because all of us have our own set of ideas about who Krishna is. I'm not saying those are wrong. I'm just saying we have to be careful not to limit Krishna to our ideas about Krishna. I may have a whole set of ideas. At the end, we may entertain some questions. I will unfold some topics. Thank you. So we can have lots of ideas about God, lots of conclusions, and all of them may be pakar, correct. But we have to be careful not to think God is only that. Even if I am a super, how to say, learned scholar, and I can quote Shastra from up to down, left to right, and I know all the supposed to verses that are supposed to be quoted when say something about who Krishna is. Again, Brahma knew a lot. Brahma is the most learned person in the universe, but he made the mistake of thinking, I know everything about Krishna. That was a mistake. So no matter how we know about him, he's always way more than that. He's always evolving. He's always expanding. So for me, one important aspect, and I try to address that in my second book, Radical Personalism, By the way, I may need to read something and I didn't bring any copies, so we can maybe take one. And the last chapter of the book is the longest chapter. And also, see this, I talk in the last chapter of the book about the material energy, no, this world, and how our understanding of this world can be very tied to our understanding of who Krishna is. Because in one sense, Krishna and this world are non-different. In one sense, they are different, bheda. In one sense, they are abheda. Our philosophy is achintya bheda abheda tattva. But sometimes we have made our philosophy achintya bheda tattva. We have overemphasized difference, no? Diversity. No? Krishna, souls, this world. And it's okay, there is difference, but also the half of the equation is abheda, which means non-difference, no? Which is the non-dual connection between all of them. In which ways we can talk about this world as non-different from God? There are so many verses in the Bhagavatam that says that. No? Prahlad Maharaj in the seventh canto has a whole series of verses saying, this world and God, they are non-different. In many ways. So also we are approaching Govardhan Puja. And Govardhan Puja is, we will be talking next Saturday on Govardhan Puja. We'll be having our next program that day. And Govardhan Puja, I mean, it's a multi-dimensional lila. We can speak about that in so many levels, in so many directions. But one of the meanings for Govardhan Puja is like reclaiming and redeeming our connection with matter, no? Nature worship. No? Sometimes in some traditions that's called animism. No? Like you are worshiping a stone, right? So to say, how it seems from no? Not only you are saying God, I worshiping the God in the stone and worshiping God as the stone. So how to accommodate all that? No? Govardhan Puja is very interesting in that connection. I like to just kick off with one little quote that I share here. This quote is from Sri Vatsa Goswami. I visited him recently in Vrindavan. He's a scholar friend from the Sri Radha Raman tradition. I share a brief quote of him here about how the worship of Govardhan Puja, and the worship of Govardhan that Krishna himself in the Bhagavatam suggests to the Vrajavasis. As we know, he cancels the whole Indra Puja. He says, let's direct all this paraphernalia to worship Govardhan. So what's one of the meanings of that? So the quote says like this. The world is the body of God, and all nature is divinized. Whereas for many Europeans, nature worship is regarded as primitive, the nature worship exemplified in the worship of Mount Govardhan is the highest form of worship. It is the highest form of religion. The Bhagavad Purana reveals that Krishna was the first to perform the worship of Mount Govardhan, and in so doing teaches the key to how to celebrate life, as life is always lived in the theater of nature. So, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yadyada charati shrishtastha sadvitarojana, whatever a great personality does, one is expected to follow. So Krishna is leading worship of Govardhan by example, worshiping of nature. So he's teaching us nature is worshipable. Material nature is worshipable. So for me, this is a very important point to rediscover our relationship with Krishna. One of being the world, in one level of our Veda-Aveda equation, the world is non-different from God. There is a place to say that. And there is a place to rediscover the divine in what sometimes we consider profane. So unfortunately, if there is someone who have made the best contribution, so to say, to create the current to create the current ecological crisis is us religious people. Because many times we have separated God from nature. We have put this in a material world. God exists very far away, totally removed from this. So then we start to see the world as profane and we start to treat it accordingly and then we have the crisis we have, in big part due to religious, quote unquote, reasons. So many traditions will, and ours included, interestingly, will try to make this point. It's okay, we are trying to love God, we are about the divine, we are about divine ecstasy. Okay, but let's begin with this world first. Let's first understand what's most immediate for us, matter. Then we can move to the soul, then we can move to the super soul. Vallabh Sampradaya will take that approach. Other Vaishnava Sampradayas will take that approach. And I will say, arguably, Gaudiya Sampradaya takes that approach. How? For example, for us, our main book is the Srimad Bhagavatam. Mahaprabhu embraced Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam pramanam amalam primapumartamam. Mahaprabhu embraced Srimad Bhagavatam as his life and heart, and from that embrace came Gaudiya Sampradaya. What's the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam? The first exposing answer of Sukadev Goswami to Parikshit Maharaj, Virat Rupa. That's how the main session of the Bhagavatam is Sukadev Goswami speaking with Parikshit. Parikshit, we know the different inquiries he made. Sukadev Goswami starts to reply by describing Virat Rupa, which basically means portraying the world as some sort of cosmic cathedral or something, describing the world in connection to God, not separate from God. The rivers are God's veins. Now, this is not a description to take literally. It's more like an analogy-like description, but at the same time, it has a purpose. It has a purpose, to see the world, to see God's presence in every aspect of the world. No? It doesn't mean that if I'm, again, in a river and I'm taking like a jar of water, or I'm cutting the veins of God, because if you take it too literally, that can be too much. But that's the initial emphasis on the Bhagavatam. See the approach. Let's start with matter, because we can talk about God, but how much of an experience we have of that, how acquainted we are in practical, experiential level of relating with God directly. So maybe we are more familiar with matter, although we may not even have a clear idea of what matter is. Even if we say, for me, matter is the most immediate thing. Yes, but that doesn't mean that you understand matter. So the Bhagavatam starts there. Let's speak about the material world in connection to God. Let's divinize nature. So let's learn to revere the world of matter in connection, in relationship to God, before diving into all the other topics, of course, that the Bhagavatam wants to bring. It's easy to just make the quantum leap and jump to the Rasa Lila, but first, instruction of the Bhagavatam is see the world in a sacred way. Find God here. If you don't find God here, you won't find God there. What's there? So until and unless we are able to find God's presence in the here and now, what warrant is that we will find him in the future? Future, in one sense, does not exist. It all depends on what's going on in the present moment. So basically, that's a very crucial lesson not to underestimate of the Bhagavatam. Whatever, all facets of existence are divine, because everything is connected with Krishna. Just to quote very basically, Brahma Samhita, Krishna is saying, Paramanu. Anu means atom, paramanu is even in the subatomic, subatomic particle, I'm there. So of course we don't have that vision, but if you at least in principle know God is in the subatomic particle and the space between them, I mean, is there something that is not sacred at that point? So in that way, all these cosmological narratives, all this description, and that doesn't appear only in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, this Virat Rupa. If you pay close attention, and this last time I'm rereading the Bhagavatam, as I try to do every year, and this time somehow by being reading other things also was, with this idea of how the Bhagavatam speaks about the material world, it was more present in me. So I was reading text, paying more attention to that. And I was really not shocked, but surprised to find not only Virat Rupa once, but in almost the beginning of every main narration that happens after that in the Bhagavatam, it always begins with some description of the world in connection to Krishna. It's like setting the foundation. First, learn to see matter as sacred. Learn to deal with the most immediate thing in the best possible way. And then we can talk about other stuff. But if you want to rush into other stuff without dealing with the immediate stuff in the best possible way, that may be a little dangerous, or in some cases even escapist. No? Let's go to Rasa Lila right now. No. First, learn to deal with matter. Right? Instead of trying to talk about the most elevated topic in a very superficial way, let's learn to talk about the most basic thing in the deepest possible way. That's the Bhagavatam. Starts with matter. So in that way, the idea is the whole world can become Udipana. Udipana, according to Rupa. So Udipana means like stimulant, like something that triggers, in this case, like your remembrance of Krishna. It's like if you are a father and you have been out in work during the whole day, Pridai was making his house the whole day, preparing the foundation, with dealing with some dynamics there. And he returns back home and he sees at the door the shoes of Sarva. No? Just the shoes. Sarva is inside. No? But this, you see the shoes, and that's Udipana, right? That triggers some feeling for your child. The child is not there, it's a few meters, but that's like triggers something. No? So in the same way, the Bhagavatam describes this world of matter in a way that it becomes Udipana. That when we contemplate the reality of matter, that can trigger in us remembrance of God. No? That's ideal. No? That this world becomes a facilitator of God's experience, not an obstacle. Because sometimes it has been typically described as an obstacle, as something that ontologically gets in the way. That by nature it will get in the way. Like even it has that intention of getting in the way. And I know that's not the case. So we need to maybe redeem our relationship with matter. That's one of the important healings, systemic healings, that many of us may need to go through as individuals and as society as well. In fact, interestingly, and I'm trying to refer as much as I can to the Shastran, so you can see that it's not my own system of philosophy I'm presenting here. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we are still referring to the Bhagavatam. Sridhar Swami is the famous Bhagavatam commentator, very deeply revered by Mahaprabhu Sri Chaitanya Dev. So he basically says the study of the physical universe is a form of yoga. And in which sense he mentions that? Again, in connection to seeing the world as sacred, that's a parallel to the difference. He makes a parallel with the 8 stages of yoga: yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. So he says the language of the Bhagavatam describing the Virat Rupa, the universal form, basically says indicates a stage of contemplation known as dharana. Again, dharana in the yoga ladder is like contemplation, so to say, like making some effort to contemplate something in a particular way. So basically saying dharana is possible in connection to the world. If you spend time trying to contemplate the sacredness inherent in matter, that's dharana. That's a form of yoga. That's a linking practice. That's an exercise that links you to the Supreme, trying to contemplate the world in connection to its source. And of course, dhyana, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Dharana takes to dhyana, to deeper meditation and to fullest absorption. And again, ultimately, everything becomes Udipana. Everything becomes stimulant to God's presence. Jo mam pasyati sarvatra sarvam cha mai pasyati, Krishna says in the 6th chapter of the Gita. That person who sees me in everything and sees everything in me, I'm never lost to him, her, she, he is never lost to me. So he's indicating there, seeing God in everything, seeing everything in God. So the exercise of contemplating the world as centering Krishna is very crucial, because that uproots the misconception of seeing the world with us in the center, with seeing everything around us for our own selfish interests. The more we learn to contemplate everything around us in connection to the divine, the more we can decentralize selfishness, basically. So Sridhar Swami basically says that thing. He directly declares that mind is controlled by concentration in the Virat Rupa. That's what he says. No? You want to control the mind? Of course, there are many things that people say, even the devotees say, how to control the mind. But one of the things, this coming from the most respected commentator of the Bhagavatam by Mahaprabhu, he's saying, want to control the mind? Concentrate on the Virat Rupa, which means pay attention to the world as sacred. Learn to see the world in connection to God. In fact, there is one verse in the Bhagavatam where Krishna himself is saying, like, the attempt to realize God as present in everywhere constitutes the best possible method of enlightenment. The attempt to try to perceive God's presence everywhere is the best method of enlightenment. And by such a practice, you end up attaining God, Krishna says. Bhagavan is attained by trying to perceive God everywhere, especially in those places where I usually do not perceive him. Again, as we always say, it all begins with perceiving God maybe in one place. That's how the Bhagavatam goes. You have the Kanishtha Adhikari who thinks, okay, God is in my there is God in my altar. Krishna is there, hyper-localized, in a corner at home. That's Krishna's place of residence. Even in my altar, in your altar, I'm not so sure, but in my altar, he's there. That's how we start perceiving God, in my corner, right? Eventually, we start to perceive God in other corners, in other altars, in other hearts, in other traditions, in other Gaudiya Vaishnava groups. In the beginning, we may not feel like that. We may feel Krishna is more, it's in my altar, it's with my guru, it's in my institution, in my mission, or it's more in mind than in others, in my religion. All these ideas that are okay for the kindergarten chapter, it's fine. It's okay. We are not being sarcastic about that. But there is a point where you need to realize that your deity is present everywhere. And eventually our vision has to broaden, has to expand, you know, to the point that I'm recognizing, again, remember the main theme of this conversation is how to rediscover my relationship with Krishna. So one of them is like to discover his presence in matter, because maybe we have thought, oh, he has nothing to do with that. For example, and I'm continuing with the Bhagavatam, in the 5th canto, and in different other sections, the planet Earth, another way of talking about the material world, the planet Earth is described as Bhu-mandala. Bhu-mandala. Now, Bhu is connected to Bhumi, to this planet, and so on. Mandala can refer to a circle, but also mandala traditionally is an ancient symbol of meditation, no? The mandala. The word mandala indicates something worthy of meditation, of spiritual focus. So if I say that the world is a mandala, bhumandala is another way of saying it's worthy of contemplation. The world's sacredness is worthy of contemplation. To contemplate the sacredness of matter is a form of spiritual practice. Of course, the Srimad Bhagavatam is mostly known for its Rasa Mandala. The Rasa Lila sometimes is called the Rasa Mandala. the circular dance of the gopis and Krishna. But I would say that prior to that mandala, to the Rasa mandala, we have to go to another mandala. We have to go to the Bhu mandala. We have to learn to see the world as sacred. So when we get to the Rasa mandala, we are understanding things in place. And in a similar way, the Bhagavatam describes the planet Earth not only as a mandala, but also as a lotus. As a lotus. And again, a lotus is an object of meditation in the Hindu canon in general. Lotus is something, we speak of lotus feet, lotus face, lotus everything. And also indicates beauty. Lotus is a symbol of beauty. So by linking the material creation to a lotus, it's speaking about there is some inherent beauty there. In the same way that you can glimpse at the existence of a music composer by listening to their music, the same way by paying attention to the material creation, you can get a glimpse of the creator, so to say. Naturally, the nature of the creator becomes extended and present in the work of creation he makes. So if we pay close attention to the world of matter, we'll find hints, and more than hints, of the divine presence there. The material creation has a very interesting background. The other day also, again, I was listening to one presentation from a scholar from the Vallabh Sampradaya, and it's very interesting because we share very much this idea that actually in our conception, and this comes from the Vedas, Vedanta, Upanishads, where the whole material creation comes as a byproduct of God's own joy. That's how described in Shastra. Vedanta Sutra says, Lokabhattu Lila Kaivalyam. Lokabhattu Lila Kaivalyam. In other words, the creation Lila, the Srishti Lila, the Lila of creation of all this, I mean, the whole creation is Krishna, God's Lila, basically. That's how it's described. Lokabhattu Lila Kaivalyam. The whole material manifestation is a Lila of God, a divine play. No? It's something that comes out of celebration. Lila means, that this is an interesting point, Lila means something that is being done without a purpose. No, I'm not doing that in order to attain something. But because I have attained something, I'm just celebrating what I've attained, and that comes as a result of that. No? It's like, for example, some of you may come, and if you're filled with joy and happiness and love, maybe you will feel yourself so fulfilled, that you will just wake up and start to dance and celebrate. Now, your dancing is not having a purpose. Now, you're not dancing to attain something. But because you have attained something, you are dancing, right? So Lila means something like that. No? Lila means there's something executed not for pleasure, but out of pleasure. You see the difference? Sorry again?
Krishna had a purpose when he came here. For instance, Lord Brahma asked him to come,
Bharat
asked him to come, so he would
remove the... Yeah, but that's Krishna's avatar coming on earth. Here we are talking about the unfolding of the whole material universe. So that's a separate category, we will say. So the unfolding of the whole material creation, which of course it has no beginning point. It's a beginning and end of different cycles. But how is depicted in the Shastra? It's like God creates out of sheer joy. Like an example given by one commentator is like a drunkard who is dancing through frenzy. No? Like you're a drunkard and you're just dancing because you're intoxicated of whatever substance. So there's somehow God himself is drunk, intoxicated of love and ecstasy. And he's dancing and celebrating. And the whole material creation comes as a result of that. That's Vedanta Sutra, which is an important text in our tradition, the Bhagavad, and it's an unfolding of that. So basically the idea is whatever that exists is the Leela of God. Whether we're talking about, because sometimes we talk about Leela in terms of what's going on in Golok Vrindavan, so to say. But this whole material creation is also a Leela. Jiva Goswami calls it Srishti Leela, the Leela of creation. He said there is an element of Leela, an element of celebration there. Of course, when we lose sight of that background, of that sacred background, we behave in ways that are not very that take us to lots of misery in this world. But the misery comes by not understanding what this world is about, actually. So this world comes as a byproduct of Krishna's joy, and therefore it's relishable to Krishna. So in one sense, we could say, if God is relishing this universe, who are we to consider this universe as bad, right? Or the question is why we are not able to relish this universe in a proper way, to honor it, to see. Or in other words, to put it more clearly, why the desire for moksha comes into the picture. I mean, we are not supposed to desire moksha in our tradition, but the desire for moksha comes into the picture, to be realistic. So if there will be, of course, again, Bhagavan is relishing material creation. If there will be some intrinsic problem in material creation, Bhagavan wouldn't be able to relish it. But he's relishing it, which shows there is something inherently good there. So if there is something inherently good, then there is no need to reject that. There's no need to even leave that, escape from that. And that's why in our tradition, moksha is contradictory to bhakti. In the ultimate, at least in principle. In realization, we may be far from that. But in principle, the notion of moksha challenges the notion of relishment. Because moksha says, there's nothing good here, let's leave this place as soon as possible. And the whole spiritual practice becomes some type of evacuation plan into the afterlife. Like, okay, in this lifetime, we have to do good, so when we leave this body, we leave this place and never return. But that's not the teaching in bhakti. What Mahaprabhu says in Sikshasika, mamajan manijan manishvare. I don't care to come birth after birth after birth, as long as Bhagavad Bhakti Rahai to keep to you, as long as I can render bhakti to you, that's my prayojan. That's my sadhana, that's my goal, my sadhya. Bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. Bhakti comes from bhakti, bhakti takes to bhakti. So again, the fact that we may feel that this world is bad and needs to be abandoned as soon as possible, that may be a symptom that we are not seeing this whole material creation as Bhagavan's Leela, as something that is potentially relishable, as something that is intrinsically sacred. because you ultimately, again, the world of matter is not bad in itself. Sometimes we use the word samsara, not like Maharaj, but samsara. Samsara dhavana lalita loka. No? This world is described as a forest fire or as an ocean, unsurmountable ocean, or as different analogies. But what does this world mean? What does samsara mean? Bhaktivinoda Thakur, for example, in his Jaiva Dharma, he will say samsara means aham mameti. That's samsara. It has nothing to do with the planet or something. It has to do with your state of consciousness. So aham mameti means I'm in mine. Where I conceive my own sense of existence according to what I think belongs to me. And I'm trying to possess things, possess people. And by that I think I'm becoming more. I'm expanding my sense of self. Aham mameti. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, that's samsara. In other words, if there's no aham mameti, there's no samsara. You are somewhere else. Despite physically being on the same planet, your consciousness is somewhere else. So, in one sense, what's going on in this world not only it's not bad, of course, I'm not saying there are not horrible things going on in this world. That's the product of human beings missing the purpose of material creation. We have to separate them. But at the same time, relationships in this world, human relationships as sadhakas, they are not something bad. Today I was reading something from Jiva Goswami's Priti Sandarbha, which is his last Sandarbha, the six Sandarbhas, and that's his treatise on Priti. Priti means love, basically. So he quotes a very interesting verse from Vishnu Purana, where Prahlad Maharaj is praying to Nrisimhadev and says, let me read the verse 1 second. He says, "O Lord, wherever I wander through whatever thousands of births, may I always have imperishable devotion to you. May I, who always remember you, have the same steadfast love for you that the non-discriminating have for sense objects, and may that love never slip out of my heart." So this is a very cryptic verse in which Prahlad Maharaj says, okay, I already love you, but also may the love that people have in this world, may that love never leave my heart. So what does it mean? So the commentators have explained that actually when Prahlad Maharaj is saying, may the love of this world never leave my heart, means in one sense, the love of this world and the love for Krishna, in one sense, the difference is centered on different people. But in many ways, the characteristics of love in this world are giving hints of how people is relating to Krishna. On some level, I'm not making a full comparison, but there is some connection between the two. I cannot tell you how many times I have talked to parents who have just had a baby, and they tell me, like, now I can understand how I can have a glimpse of how Yashoda must feel for Krishna. Now I can have a glimpse of what it feels to. Again, they are not making a full comparison, but somehow they are relating their experience to that. And there is a place for that. No, that's not heresy. In one way, in order to understand what's called alaukika rasa, or the mellows that are supramundane, one has to understand for alaukika rasa. There is some relationship. That's why Rupa Goswami bases his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu on Bharat Natya Shastra. Natya Shastra speaks about the emotions in this world, and on that foundation he elaborates on the emotions in the other world. So all this to say, there's no need to discard matter, but actually we can discover Krishna here. Matter can become a portal, can become a window of access. Some months ago, I read one interesting quote in Brihad Bhagavatamrita by Sanatana Goswami, and he will say that if you learn to honor a blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is, you attain all perfection. That's again a very interesting idea. He's saying, if you learn to relate to even the most insignificant aspect of this world, let's say a blade of grass, with all respect to the blade of grass, if you learn to relate to a blade of grass for what the blade of grass is, which is something in connection to Krishna, then you will attain perfection because you will perceive Krishna's presence in that blade of grass. The blade of grass will talk to you about Krishna. So to say, that's what Mahaprabhu experienced. Trinada, Pisanichin, he looked at the blade of grass and the blade of grass was talking to him. It was a guru. Then he looked at the tree, Tarodiva, Sahishnana, the trees talking. It's guru there, guru tattva, showing tolerance, humility. So in potential, although we may not have that vision, I agree, let's be realistic. It's not that we go out and we see every tree and the trees are talking to us and the blade of grass became our guru. Hopefully that's the case, but sometimes it's not the case. But at least in principle, we should know that's the case. In potential, I know that every tree can teach me the same lesson that Mahaprabhu learned from the tree. It's not that Mahaprabhu saw a special tree. He saw that in any tree with a special vision. And it's a vision that we are supposed to acquire. This third verse of Shikshastakam, in which we find these famous lines, represent the stage of Nishtha. So it's not even about Bhava or Prem, it's Nishtha. So when you are in Nishtha, which is stable bhakti, when you're in Nishtha, you start to listen so attentively that everywhere you are receiving Udipana, everywhere you are receiving stimulants in your connection to Krishna, blade of grass, tree. You are really present to everything and everyone, basically. The fact that sometimes we don't see or we don't listen to things is because we are not present. We lack presence many times. So in one sense, Krishna consciousness means bringing presence to what's going on around us already. So, and when you are present to everything as it is, you start to see everything as it is, which means in their relationship with Krishna. So I said the other day, Prabhupada published Bhagavad Gita as it is, but we want everything as it is. Everything has to be as it is. So, and we, even some of the things I'm talking about have more to do with sattva guna. Not even with Visuddha Sattva or transcendence. No? For example, Sattva Guna means the knowledge of everything in connection to Krishna. Now, in Sattva Guna, you start to see things in relationship with the center. Rajagun implies, how to say, speaking about variety without seeing the underlying unit. That's Rajasic knowledge. You speak in terms of diversity and variety, but you lose sight of the underlying unit, which means sattva, higher vision is you speak in variety, but you keep sight of the underlying unit. You see that everything is bonded and tied with Krishna as its essence. So material energy, again, is not exception to that rule. In fact, as we were talking the other day, just two more thoughts before concluding, and then we have questions, if you have comments. Material nature is described by Bishwanath Chakravarti Thakur as a devotee with the highest devotion. So try to imagine, from sometimes the distorted idea of, okay, the world of matter is against me, there is some conspiracy going on, Maya Shakti wants me falling down, she's praying for making me her victim. We sometimes project all these satanized ideas on Maya Shakti, which is a Shakti in the service of Bhagavan. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said, no, material energy, he said, one should have faith that the material energy is a devotee with the highest devotion. So if material energy is a devotee with the highest devotion, sometimes we speak in terms of, that's an interesting shift of perspective. Sometimes we talk in terms of engaging matter in the service of Krishna. But if material energy is the highest devotee, she's already engaged in the service of Krishna. So how much I am engaging matter in the service of Krishna, or matter is allowing me to engage myself in the service of Krishna. Right? If matter is the highest, a Vaishnavi of the highest order, how much she's giving me sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha, and giving me the grace to engage in the service of Krishna, instead of me being the redeemer of matter. No? Like by my grace, all this matter is being spiritualized and purified by being engaged in the service. But from according to what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, material energy is already a devotee of the highest devotion. So probably I can think, oh, material energy is facilitating me, helping me, is allowing me to engage myself. I am the one who is not engaged in bhakti. So through matter, I can engage in bhakti in so many ways. So So from that place, I can conceive of material energy as giving me her grace. No. One name, one meaning of Maya is mercy, interestingly. No. One meaning of Maya is mercy. So we can say in that way, okay, matter, Maya, matter is giving me grace, no, to serve. Through the grace of matter, I'm given the opportunity to engage my senses in the service. If properly conceived, we can talk about material energy from that perspective. Of course, sometimes we find some other descriptions of Shastra about the material world as miserable and all that stuff, but that speaks about when we approach matter with the wrong vision, then misery will come from our wrong approach. It's not that matter in itself is miserable. It's a Vaishnavi of the highest order. Just by the very fact that Krishna is everywhere, how can something be profane? Again, just apply that simple logic. Once Srila Prabhupada said, this is a very interesting way. He said, the Supreme Lord is situated everywhere, and wherever he is situated is a temple. So the Supreme Lord is situated everywhere, and whatever the Supreme Lord is situated is his temple. So everywhere is his temple. He didn't say that. He just left that for us to conclude naturally. Now, if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then you make the math and conclude the rest of the part. A is equal to C. So if God is situated everywhere as he is, every atom, and wherever he's situated is his temple, every atom is his temple. There is not a place that is not his temple. It's just that we are not aware of that fact. It's just that we are not Krishna conscious, basically. To be Krishna conscious means to be conscious of who Krishna is, where Krishna is, and which are the implications of all that. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, everything is a temple, and nothing is profane. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the word profane comes from the Latin two words, pro and fanum. And pro fanum means outside of the temple. So again, I just mentioned, whatever God is a temple. So in principle, everywhere is a temple. So what profane means outside of the temple, which basically means to be profane means like I cannot be outside of the temple, but I can be unaware that I am in the temple and behave in a profane way. You follow my point? So it's not so much about, sometimes we will make a temple. I'm not against constructing a temple, no, because we can say, okay, everywhere is a temple. There's no need for temples. Yeah, but we don't have that awareness. So we need to construct a temple to realize eventually that everywhere is a temple. We need to craft some sacred space so it reminds us that everywhere is a sacred space. I remember some months ago we were in the U.S., in North Carolina, and we were celebrating Ekadasi, and we tried to make some special celebration and do kirtan for many hours during the night. We were in nature, and we made a sacred, we crafted some special space, you know, with leaves and flowers and a fire in the center and some arrangements. So that ceremonies, that ritual space we created helped us to be attuned to the fact that, oh, everything is sacred, right? But we needed to make that concerted effort to create that space, to develop that awareness. So in the same way, yeah, the temple is a state of consciousness. To be in the temple, to go to the temple, is not a physical act, but it's where we are internal. That's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, Mama Mandir, he will sing, the temple of my being. You ultimately, you have to construct a temple in your heart. So the object of these senses, this material world, is not necessarily entangling us. It's not necessarily bad, but it's the consciousness we have that does so. No? So I'll tell you a brief story just to conclude in this connection that shows how it's not that the world of matter is bad and it's capturing us and it's taking us, but it's how we choose to relate to that. If we choose to relate from an enlightened place, everything is a temple. There's not a place Krishna is not. But if we choose to relate to matter from an unenlightened place, it's our consciousness that is capturing us. No? So there was once one disciple living in an ashram, and this disciple was very austere, no? Didn't have almost anything. No? So this is described that he only had one coping, no? A loincloth. Just that was his only possession. But there happened to be a mouse in the ashram. So the mouse liked to eat the cloth. So he only had a coping, but the mouse liked the coping, so to say. So the disciple was like, okay, I will get a cat. No? So the mouse leaves. So he got a cat, the mouse left. But now the cat wanted milk. So, okay, I have to get milk. So I need to get a cow. No? So he gets a cow. Mm-hmm. But I don't have time to milk the cow and pick up the cow dung. So I need to get a servant to assist me in that. So he gets a servant. And then, again, the whole story goes that then he gets a wife and then he gets children. And the guru was with that disciple when he was only having one coping, so to say. And the guru went for traveling, and when he returned, he found the disciple with the coping still there, but the mouse is no longer there, but now there is a cat, and there is a cow, and there is a servant, and there is a wife, and there are children. And the guru was like, what happened? And the disciple said, like, oh, Gurudev, I'm trapped by all these sense objects. I'm trapped by them. They trap me. So the guru is like, okay. So the guru goes for bathing in the nearby river. So at one point the disciple is in the house and hears his guru shouting, like, help, help, no, I'm drowning, help, help. So the disciple goes running. Well, Gurudev is drowning. So when he arrives, he sees the guru in the water and he's like taking a branch from a tree, nearby tree. No? And he said, I'm trapped here. No, he didn't say I'm drowning. He said, help, help. So when the disciple came, say, like, he sees the guru like holding very tightly this branch. And he's like, what's going on? So like, I'm tied to this tree. No? This tree is capturing me, it's entangling me. The disciple said, look, just let it go. Just let the branch go. That's it. No? No? And of course, the guru insists, no, it's entangling me, it's taking me. No? So what want to make the same point? You know, like you can say, oh, this whole world is capturing me and it's entangling me and I'm tied by these objects. No, you're just holding on to that stuff from some particular place that is not healthy. But if you have the proper consciousness to relate to them, there are facilitators. That's what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said. His famous song, Vaishnava Ki, no? Verse 13, 14, he said, all the objects of the senses, all the elements of this world, are potential paraphernalia in the service of Bhagavan. I mean, they're already serving Bhagavan, as we say. They are potential in the sense that we have not yet tuned in to the frequency of service. And when we engage with them properly, all this object of the senses become none different from Bhagavan himself, he says. Whatever that means, but he mentioned that point. All the objects of the senses become none different from God. You have this particular realization of every atom of this world is sacred. So anyhow, I want to share some thoughts in this particular direction today, in the context of our big broader conversation of rediscovering our relationship with Krishna, since I personally consider in general in our Gaudiya Sampradaya we need to redeem, reclaim and heal our relationship with matter and learn to see this world with God's presence in it. Again, if we want to relate to Krishna and perceive God in our life, why not to start from the most immediate reality that is in front of our senses, like matter? There's lots of validation coming from Shastra and our tradition to do so. So a few thoughts I want to share with you about that today. in connection, as I say, and in anticipation also to the Govardhan Lila we'll be celebrating on Saturday, which has a lot to do with nature worship and any other related topics. So now, before concluding, of course, we have some minutes. So if someone has questions or comments or things you would like to share, you can raise your hand and we can... Yes, sorry, we had to wait 1 hour for that.
Yeah, I was only going to ask you, shall I wait till the end? That's all.
Sorry.
Okay, so we'll take a minute to phrase this problem.
No problem.
So in relation to our relationship with the law, in the material world, we have the five rasas with each other, and we have relationship with each other, and we can see that everywhere. And inside each person is the super soul. So inadvertently, we have relationship with the super soul. So when we attain perfection in the Loka, then we have a relationship with Gurudev and whatever rasa we're in. Hopefully in Lalita's group, and then Radharani and Krishna, etc. So that's kind of localized to one area, which is what we feel in this world now, it's localized. However, our earth is very small, little tiny place, but Krishna Loka is more than the whole universe. So does Krishna expand himself everywhere? And there is unlimited Krishnas everywhere. And would that also mean that Krishna is never without Radharani? So that is Radharani everywhere? Is there duplicates of Radharani everywhere? And then Radharani is not without Ranita or Vishaka or the Gopis or the Shakis or Manjaris. So is there just duplicates everywhere? And what is the situation? It's kind of mind-boggling when you try and conceive of it. Is it localized or is it just a replica everywhere?
Yeah. Thank you for the question. And of course, maybe the first thing I will say in reply is it's mind-boggling. And we can say something, as I will try, but also we have to keep in mind that no matter what we can say, words can never replace experience of that. Like some situation when, I don't know, sometimes devotees will ask Srila Prabhupada, okay, Prabhupada, I've studied the daily schedule of Krishna in Golok. No? So at this time of the day, he does this in this place of Vrindavan. And then at this time, he's in this place of Vrindavan. And then he said, but I have measured the distance from each place to each place. And there's no time for him to reach to one place to another. He's like you, he got so quite caught here, right? And Prabhupada say different things to this type of questions. For example, he once said, like, Golok Vrindavan is compared to a lotus, so the lotus have different petals, and each lila stali, each place of pastimes, is a petal. Sometimes the lotus is open. And Krishna is doing a pastime here in Govardhan, whatever, and he needs to reach the next place. And to reach the next place, the lotus closes. So Krishna just passed to the other petal. He gave that type of answer, right? In some cases, he will say some devotees like, you are thinking too much, which can happen. I mean, at the same time, we have to think, no? Sarva, welcome. Nant, welcome. Okay. Now finally the event is getting exciting. So yeah, this is similar to what is described in the Bhagavatam when Krishna is meeting with the 16,000 queens. And he expands in forms that are different to each other. You know? Like each one is doing different things. And again, that's mind-boggling. Because it's the same person. And Narad Muni was going quickly to one place to another to see, okay, maybe I caught Krishna leaving to the other place. But no. There was Krishna everywhere doing different things. But it was it was the same person, but multiple at the same time. So it's one and different, so to say, one and multiple. So in connection to your question, we could say, of course, there are, if we talk in terms of Golok Vrindavan, even in union or even in separation, because we heard about Lilas, the dynamics of union and separation. So you can say, okay, in union, Krishna is with his devotees. And one could argue, in separation, he is not. He's absent. But at the same time, we know that in another way, he's more present in separation. Though externally, he may not be visible. That's what Rupa Goswami says. Like, in union with Krishna, you see one Krishna. The one is in front of you. In separation of Krishna, you see thousands of Krishnas. Because Krishna starts to appear everywhere. Everything starts to remind you, Krishna, Krishna. So, and we wouldn't say, oh, that's a delusion they are having. They are crazy. That's not real. That's false. No, that's true. They are perceiving Krishna. That's one of the reasons some acharyas say when Krishna left, quote unquote, Vrindavan to go to Mathura and Dwarka, and eventually he was asked, why you don't return? He will have one of the reasons sometimes Chara says that because they are so immersed in separation that if I return, maybe they won't even notice. The Vrajavasis are in another dimension of absorption and they are meeting me in that separation. That there is this concept of union in separation. No, like externally, they are not seeing me, but all their feelings get internal. Like if I love you, and then I'm with you physically, and then you travel for 10 years, I'm not seeing you physically. So all my feelings for you get internalized, get condensed internally. Of course, when I see you physically, all that becomes externalized. But in your absence, it becomes so internalized that arguably you are more present because of that condensation. So we generally do not hear so much that Krishna, there are different ways to say. We may not hear that there are replicas of Krishna everywhere, but at the same time, or that there's always Krishna with Radha, because sometimes we see in the Lila, Krishna's in one place, Radha's in another. Again, in a more substantial way, they are never separated. There are different, again, language cannot do justice to that. There are different ways to speak about it. At the same time, something that we can say, Krishna says in the Gita, "Ye atamam prapadyante tam stataiva vajamyaham." As you approach me, I reciprocate accordingly. So also we could say that for every devotee, there's one Krishna, unique, that exists to reciprocate with that love. Now, again, it's the same person, but somehow that same person adopts unique, specific forms to reciprocate with every devotee. It's not that there's only the Krishna in Dwarka, the Krishna in Mathura, and the Krishna in Vrindavan, or the Krishna in Madhurya Rasa, the Krishna in Sakya Bhav, the Krishna in Vatsalya Rasa. There's the Krishna of every devotee, because every devotee has a particular type of bhakti, and that bhakti makes Krishna appear in a particular way to reciprocate accordingly to that bhakti. There are many verses in the scripture that say the form of Bhagavan appears according to the desires of the devotee. So every devotee's desires are never identical from the other one. So arguably, we could make the case that there is one Krishna for every devotee, right? I mean, Krishna, I'm not saying that we divided God and we have many gods, but it's the same non-dual, indivisible personality manifesting in unique forms to reciprocate them. To each unique heart, so to say. So that will be a way for me to speak about it, now in terms of how these personalities exist in the spiritual world. But yeah, at the end of the day, words are so limited. You know? So we can say something, but as Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, okay, we can try to think and talk as much as we can, but also we need to know when to stop talking, when to stop thinking. I want to enter into prayer and meditation, and whatever hasn't been revealed by words of thinking will be revealed beyond that. No, so there is a place to go to that place also, and enter into silence enter into inner practice and receive what cannot be put into words, basically, something like that, right? Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Can you just... Samsara is like mama.
That?
There are accidents.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
So in the regular world, we have accidents. We have like innocent people. It's just the nature also. That's what I've heard. It's like the nature of the regular world is dangerous things happen, accidents happen. It is miserable. So, and it's degrading. Kaliga is, we can see with a lot of proof that it's degrading. So then how can we understand that maybe Krishna can enjoy because he's not affected, but as conditioned souls, we become very vulnerable to the material world. So how is it, I don't know, is, what if we become complicit in the name of, oh, Krishna, this world is created out of joy, so we should also learn to see that. It's very
okay. So On one side we have this side, this point of scripture described that the whole material universe comes from the joy of God, like implying the world of matter is rooted in God's love. It has that imprint. It's the ideal purpose is that. Now we lose sense of that, sight of that, and material world ends up being hell, so to say. So when we, any of us, any person, ends up suffering in this world, let's say, going through very harsh, difficult things, that doesn't mean that Krishna is just like, okay, I'm having such a great time and I don't care for your misery. No, that's not the point. No, the point is, on one side, yes, the world is described as coming from God's heart, but when in that context, in the context of the world, people go through different experiences of suffering, tragedy, whatever, it is also described that God empathizes with that and God accompanies compassionately the world, the soul in that. That's another form of love also. No? The whole world comes from God's love, and one aspect of love is compassion. No? So that's how Krishna is also accompanying the suffering of the different souls in this world. Those who understand the purpose of the world and are celebrating along with God and are seeing the divine in everything, Krishna is celebrating along with them. And those who forever, for whatever reason, are losing sight of that and are suffering the consequences of losing sight of that, Krishna is loving them in a compassionate way by being present with them as much as he can, and by trying to facilitate the best possible scenario that he can for their situation. I like to give the example of the GPS, like, which is you are driving and you GPS say turn right and you turn left. So the GPS will say recalculating. No? So according to your last mistake, let's think of the best possible scenario. The storm has came. He's known as the storm in intermediate circles. That's why I say. So I like to give that example, right? You turn in the wrong direction and the GPS immediately thinks what's the best possible way for you considering your previous mistake, and this recalculating, here you have, go here, you go the wrong turn again, recalculating. So in the same way, whenever we took the wrong turn, so to say, Krishna is always adapting and trying to facilitate the best possible situation for us to learn what we need to learn in that particular chapter. So yeah, on one side we have the world is coming out of God's heart and God's love, and despite the suffering and the misery and the pain, God's love remains there in different forms, you know, compassion for those who suffer and so on and so forth. Yeah. And I will argue one last thing. I will argue that Kali Yuga, despite being what it is, no need to enter into the details of degrading things within Kali Yuga, I will describe Kali Yuga in black and white terms also. Like, I also see that due to that degradation, and maybe not due to that, but as a counter force to that, there are also many interesting things, positive things happening in Kali Yuga. And I wouldn't limit that just because of the Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement, no? Because that sounds a little bit sectarian. Like, whatever happens good in Kali Yuga is only because of my religion. It's like, no. So again, there are very horrible, degrading things that never happened before. That I'm not denying that. But at the same time, there is some like parallel universe or current of an awakening of many people in many directions, like never happened before either. So that's interesting. Like coexisting of these different forces, so to say. And of course, one chooses in which where to live, so to say, mostly. That's kind of what Mahabhagavatam also creates, that contrast in the last canto, 12th canto, describing Kali Yuga. And it sounds like apocalyptic, like, oh my gosh, what I'm doing here. But then starts to praise Kali Yuga, dear. Kalim Sambhavanti Sabaj, what is Kalim Sabajam Sambhav? Kalim Savajayanti Arya. No? The great personalities are longing to be born in Kali Yuga. Kalar Doshani Deyaraj Jasti Hek Mahaguna Kirtana Deva Krishna Samukta Sangha Pramrita. This Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults, but it has this great quality that by chanting the name of Krishna, you can attain liberation and so on. And again, that can be extended beyond one's own religion, so to say. But we could say that Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults. You can see faults everywhere. But at the same time, you can see that there are some pretty good things going on at the same time. So we choose in which Kali Yuga to live, so to say. Though, of course, even if I choose to immerse myself as much as I can in Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement, that doesn't mean that I won't be aware of what's going on around me. But I have to, yeah. From that place of shelter, I can relate to the degradation of Kali Yuga hopefully with compassion, hopefully with a soft heart, not just like pointing and criticizing and condemning people, but all that may bring to me more love, more of a soft heart, right? Like I was reading yesterday, Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Vasudev Datta famously is praying to Mahaprabhu, please give me a boon, allow me to stay here, and to receive the karma of all living entities, and you just release all of them. And Mahaprabhu, when he hears that, he says his voice starts to break, to tremble, his body trembles, he starts to cry, he becomes so moved by seeing the compassion of his devotee. So my point is, there is a place for devotees connecting with the suffering of other people. No, it's not just about I'm on my own thing and I don't care. That's their karma. Sometimes this idea of their karma can be like very dismissive and indifferent. And that's not the spirit. The spirit is like, I realize they are suffering and my heart breaks because of that. Also, I was reading the other day a prayer by Rantidev in the 9th canto. Basically, he says the same thing. Like, I don't want liberation. I don't want to transcend this world. I just want to stay here and suffer with the people of this world. This is kind of the bodhisattva version in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. In Buddhism, they have this bodhisattva vow that they vow, I will return to this world till the last person becomes enlightened. Some they have like that determination. So something like that is coming in the Bhagavatam through the prayers of Rantideva. I'm not saying everyone has to say that or feel like that, but I'm saying that's there, so there is a place for that also. There are different ways of being a devotee. There are different ways of being inspired in one's life and practice. No?
Yeah. I'm glad you're saying how the holy name liberates us in Kali Yuga, but it's not limited to just, that. But isn't that maybe that's the mission of believing that's the truth, but I think I also mentioned how it's not just limited to our practice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost not trying the holy name. What
No, I wouldn't say that.
This is so new.
Sorry?
This is very new.
I mean, I wouldn't say that everyone has to reach a point where they have to be chanting the name of Krishna. No, no, there are different ways to worship God and to attain liberation. And there, I mean, just to begin, there are different sampradayas. Even Vaishnava sampradaya, not necessarily all of them chant the name of Krishna. So for me, it doesn't make sense to think all of them in the next birth have to be born as Gaudiya Vaishnavas for them to attain the goal, because that would be even offensive, no? To say that all the Balavis have to become Gaudiyas, all the Ramanujas have to become Gaudiyas, all the Madhavas, everyone has to be Gaudiya Vaishnava. If not, you still are here. No, that sounds dangerously fanatic. Of course. There are different destinations. There are different paths. That's okay. And that's okay. No, again, it's not that everyone's cup of tea, my cup of tea is everyone's cup of tea. No, what I want, what I like, it's not what everyone else likes.
There is a sense of superior complex, right? That who is the highest.
There shouldn't be. I will say there has to be a sense of this is the best for me, but not like for everyone, trying to like establish that universally. I mean, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says in Chaitanya Charitamrita, every devotee feels his relationship with Krishna is the best, or with God, because it may be another form of God. Every devotee feels my relationship with God is the best, and everyone is correct, he says. He's not saying, and everyone is wrong except for the Hare Krishna. No, he's not saying that. That's what we're talking today. That's what we learn from the first book of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. If you consider Gaudiya Sampradaya starting from Mahaprabhu, one way of thinking, the first book is Brihadbhagavatamrita by Sanatana Goswami. And then you have this journey of Gopakumar. And Gopakumar is visiting so many devotees with so many different types of faith, worshipping different forms of God. What is his, and his own aspiration is Krishna in Vrindavan as a friend. But he's not going for all these places bullying all the people, like saying, oh, you're not worshiping Krishna, you are inferior, you have to know the real thing, come with me, I have a book for you. he's actually appreciating, no? He's actually appreciating everyone else's devotion, staying with them some time, being imbibed by their mood, but then feeling, yeah, but I'm being called to something else. But he's not rejecting any of that. He's just saying, that's not my call, but that's beautiful. No, again, that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. No, let me read you one quote that I shared here, but I have to recall which is the. Let me see, one second. Which extends beyond, of course, any particular tradition. Okay, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says like this, and with this probably we can conclude. Bhaktivinoda Thakur from Chaitanya Charitamrita. For me, this is one of the main statements about interfaith appreciation. No? And we are today in one very particular place with, we have beautiful altars here of Jesus as well. So if one goes to someone else's place of worship, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, one should think, these people are worshiping my Lord, but in a different way. Because of my different training, I cannot quite comprehend this system of worship. However, through this experience, I can deepen my appreciation for my own system of worship. The Lord is only one, not two. I offer respect to the form I see here and pray to the Lord in this new form that he increases my love for the Lord in his accustomed form. Those who do not follow this procedure, but instead criticize other systems of worship and show hatred, violence, and envy, are worthless and foolish. The more they indulge in useless quarreling, the more they betray the very goal of their religion. So that's Bhaktivinoda Thakur, no? Showing this standard of how we are supposed to see and appreciate other traditions. And even you can have dialogue with people. That has been my experience. You can have dialogue. I have, as you may know, dialogue, podcast, conversation with people from Christian tradition, Jewish tradition. And I always end up the conversations on fire, so to say, like very inspired, very, very imbued with things that came from them. But somehow they, those things helped me rediscover my own tradition. I never think, conclude thinking, okay, I may have to stop being a Gaudiya Vaishnava. I mean, there are ghosters. On the contrary, it's like, wow, you're saying those things with those words from that perspective. And we will say it in this way, but this is interesting. And that helps me to so there is a place to rediscover your own tradition from other traditions. And if that's the case, how much I can speak about them as other tradition, how much I can draw a line. This is a different thing. Of course, there may be differences, but also there is so much in common. So we have to be very expert to navigate. I would say first to establish the basis of unity, commonality, and on that foundation, the diversity will become like an ornament, not a disruption, not an obstacle, not a disturbance, but an ornament. If the foundation of unity is in place first. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
You mentioned about Guru Mangala. So you mentioned that Guru Mangala is the flat earth, like the round mandala.
Okay.
So it's in the 10th canto, it's mentioned that in Kali Yuga, the Vedic injunctions would be broken down by the atheistic theories.
Mm.
So if Guru Mangala is flat, and our Earth is obviously part of Guru Mangala, what does that mean for this scientific understanding of where it's floating around in space?
There are different opinions about that, as you know, even in the Gaudiya Vaishnava community, whether the Earth is circular or is flat, as you mentioned. I mean, I've not, to be honest, enter into the details of the discussion, because there is a huge discussion.
I don't think they're interested in Shastri.
But there's lots of big discussion based on Shastra with different like opinions and perspectives of what Shastra is saying, because also sometimes Shastra says different things that lend itself to interpretation, different types of interpretation. So I heard about this saying, okay, this certain statement seem to describe the earth as flat. This other statement seems to describe it as round. I've heard about saying, well, it's flat in some places and it's round in others. Some others will tell, well, Sukadev Goswami is describing it as such, but
what does he mention?
Yeah, again, one thing will be like, okay, Sukadev Goswami is describing it as such, but from which perspective Sukadev Goswami is talking, because he's speaking from a very ecstatic place. Bhumandal also sometimes is referred to as as a more subtle dimension beyond the physical realm that we are perceiving. So there are many, 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 many considerations in that connection. And again, I'm not an expert in that particular realm. To be honest, it's not something that captures my attention that much, but of course, I'm totally open to open discussions about these topics, as long as they are respectful and appreciative, and trying to consider, of course, what Shastra is saying. And again, it's interesting because sometimes Shastra will say different things.
What is it that people think?
Sorry?
You say that interesting that sometimes Shastra says this. Mm-hmm. Is it that people think Shastra says this?
Well, of course, that can happen also.
Is it the people's interpretation?
That's also happening, yeah. But also, Shastra says things, and there are different ways of, I mean, there's not only one way of interpreting Shastra. That's a point also. And that there are, for example, we read the verses of the Bhagavatam, and we read the different commentaries, and different commentators say different things sometimes, no? Not necessarily contradictory, but just different. They're finding different things in the same verse. So I make just that point beyond this topic, but there's not just one correct way of interpreting what the verse, but also again, that doesn't mean that, okay, I can just interpret it as I like, and that's my reading of it, and that can be outside of of the parameters of proper Shastric interpretation. That's a whole art to interpret scripture, hermeneutics, that's called. And how to interpret sacred scripture. It's not just like, okay, I read it according to my own filters and I accommodate to justify what I need to justify. Because if you want to do that, you can do that with Shastra also. You can just justify serial killing out of the Bhagavad Gita if you take it in your own concocted way. So, yeah, so many things can be done. In one sense, Shastra is a kalpa vriksha, a desire tree. So you, whatever you want, you will find a justification for that. That doesn't mean that Shastra's intention is that, but so that's, of course, the importance why sacred scripture is to be ideally understood by revelation and sadhusanga and parampara and certain chain that gives a context to what the text is talking about. And on that foundation, new revelations can come also. It's not that, okay, just the previous acharya said everything and nothing else can be said. That's not parampara. Parampara is always something new can come, but the something new just has to come in certain context also, no? Honoring and respecting tradition, right? Doesn't mean that something new contradicting everything else that has been said before. So, yeah, sometimes I like to give the example of the parrots, now two parrots. Now you have the parrot who, you can be a parrot just parroting, literally, what other people said or the previous acharya said, which is not entirely bad. In the beginning, we may just, that may be what we can do, just repeating what others said, because I cannot just bring my own realizations yet. So that's a type of parrot, it's fine. But the highest parrot, sometimes Sukadev Goswami is described as such, as the one who bites the fruit and makes it sweeter. No, like the, who can not just parrot what others say, but constantly add new layers that increase the sweetness of what has been already given. No? So, which ideally is what parampara is about. No? Each new member of this disciple succession has to make their own contribution, not limit yourself to repeat what others say. You may have to begin like that, but eventually you will have your own voice, your own heart, your own contribution to make.
In the 11th canto, Lord Krishna mentions that Shabda Brahman, the realization that you need to understand Shastra, it acts on four different levels.
Mm.
One is external, like and three internal levels. Mm-hmm. So, sadly, the most of the people trying to understand this topic, this particular topic of the Vedic universe, so to speak, they're following in the footsteps of modern science.
Mm.
And so they're not entering into the three inner levels of Shabda.
Mm.
They're on the external level, and they're following the teachings of science and trying to fit that into the Vedic Tantra's teachings.
Mm.
And then they propose a theory based on that.
Mm.
Mm. And this is the saddest part I find in relation to this.
Mm. Mm. Thank you. Thanks for sharing.
I actually spent 25 years studying this particular topic.
Oh, okay.
That's a lot. There's a lot you said. I wonder if you said.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's what I meant. I have not spent the time necessary in the topic like that. So, yeah. You have a question, Megan, or a comment, something you'd like to share?
So, in order to see Krishna in the matter, how much do you think we should be aware, like, with our intention, aware of all the things happening in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Evil.
Well, of course, that all depends on your capacity to deal with that, because nowadays, especially, we are in a time where you can have access to so many things that are happening at the same time, that in the past you wouldn't know about all those things, but now due to global digital communication, it's like, whew. And that can be also overwhelming, no? Because so many terrible things may be happening at this precise moment simultaneously, and it's not that you want to be insensitive to that, indifferent to that, but also you have your own limit of how much you can process of that without becoming like overwhelmed by that, no? And without losing sight that other things are happening also, some good things. Because generally when we go, okay, let's see the news, you don't hear generally like the news of people getting enlightened and doing beautiful things. So it can be overwhelming. So one I will say one should find the point in one's own situation where you can, how to say, for most, and I'm not saying for everyone, but at least I'm talking for me, what's healthy for me is I don't want to lose touch with the pain of the world. I think that helps me to keep my heart open in a compassionate way and keeps me human and empathic. But also, if I go too much to that as if that's the only thing that is going on, of course, I lose sight of so much more. So it's a constant like navigating that balance, no? Like, I don't want to just, okay, I only want to talk about Rasa Lila, and actually I may need to deal with the suffering of this world, because the suffering of this world includes me also. No? It's not that I'm beyond that in one sense. It's not that I'm not suffering. It's not that I'm not perpetrating something of that myself. So how can I find that middle point where I contact the pain of the world, but in a way that also creates compassion in me? No? So also you have to pay attention to the fruit of that. No? Because again, if my just contacting the pain of the world makes me depressed or bewildered or overwhelmed, and then just end up thrown on the corner, so to say, that can happen. What's the purpose of that, right? So how to contact pain, suffering in a way that opens my heart, creates compassion, and allows me to see God present in that situation, no? And to bring God present to that situation for those who are not seeing it. How to balance that with probably my time of private prayer and practice, to like go back to focus of what is what. So whenever I go back to the pain of the world, so to say, I don't lose sight of what's actually going on. So it has to be a balance, no, of inner culture, prayer, connection, and giving myself in those situations, opening myself to that without losing sight of what's going on, without stopping being compassionate. So for each person is different, no? The capacity to do that. And each person will feel different calls in how to deal with that. It's not that everyone has to do it in the same way. We find in many traditions people who are more, I don't know, retired in a cave and living a life of prayer. But from there, they are also making their contribution. And that's their nature. If that's their nature, if that's not escapism. And some other people may be ultra engaged in social dynamics in the world, and that's their nature and that's their service. Some people is a little bit and a little bit, 70-30, 60-40, 50-50. Again, there's no one size fits all, so one has to find your own nature and your own call. You know, that's what the Bhagavatam says, Sve Sve Adhikari Yanishta Saguna Parikirtita. To acknowledge what's your adhikar, it's real virtue, real beauty. So to acknowledge what's your nature, what's your call, what you can do, and to do it in a sustainable way. I'm not saying that's easy, but that's important, yeah? So we can find our place in that. And again, for everyone that may be different, so we should be careful not to be just comparing ourselves with everyone else, how everyone else is doing it, because that may not be the way I'm supposed to be doing it, and so on and so forth. Yeah, individuation. Okay, so I think we'll put the discussion to rest. We have already been almost 2 hours, so I don't want also to make it that long. And of course, those who have time and wish, we will be meeting again on Saturday morning at the house where we have been doing the programs the previous days. For on 10:30 Saturday for Govardhan Puja. So we'll be continuing with the main theme of how to rediscover Krishna in our life, but all that in the context of the narrative of the Govardhan Lila and some of the lessons that we can extract from the Govardhan Lila in connection to how to rediscover Krishna in our lives. Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavind ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bo, Vancha Kalpataru Vishcha, Kripa Sindhu Vacha, Titanam Pavane Pyo Vaishnave Pyo Namo Namo, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Hari Hari Bo.